Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Does a newly surfaced State Department memo jeopardize the Massachusetts federal lawsuit against President Trump's executive order on immigration?
We had not been aware that there was an official legal decision to revoke all visas for the seven countries, all immigrant and non-immigrant visas for the seven countries.
Also, as that lawsuit pushes back against the president's actions, would you be surprised to learn that the nativist rhetoric Trump uses was actually born in Boston a century ago? And our special series, This Moment in Cancer, hears from a patient treated with cutting-edge therapies.
I wish science was a little bit more advanced. I mean, I know it's going to happen. It's just the clock is not perfect for me. But I just got 5 years out of them, so most people don't get there.
That's next on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll begin today with major developments in the Massachusetts lawsuit challenging President Donald Trump's executive order on immigration. A new State Department memo has surfaced revoking the visas from visitors from seven Muslim-majority countries named in Trump's order. And the memo may explain why travelers with tickets to Logan Airport are not being allowed to board flights, despite a Boston federal court order on Sunday that put a seven-day hold on Trump's actions. Joining us now with more is WBUR's Shannon Dooling. She's been reporting on this story today. Hi there, Shannon.
Hi, Meghna.
Okay, so this new State Department memo, what's in it?
Right, so the memo's dated January 27th, the same day President Trump signed his executive order. It's signed by Deputy Assistant Director for Visa Services, Edward Ramotowski, and it provisionally revokes all valid non-immigrant and immigrant visas of people from the seven countries listed in the executive order. So Iraq, Iran, Syria, Somalia, Sudan, Libya, and Yemen. So by using the word provisionally there, it basically means that it can be reversed at some point by the State Department. Now, it does list exceptions for people traveling on diplomatic visas, but this memo would apply to student visas, travel visas, any non-diplomatic visa, really. And I should say, Meghna, this does not appear on the State Department website that I could see. It's not clear that visa holders who are affected have even been notified.
Interesting. So, I mean, as far as we know, the public wasn't made aware of this memo until today, even though, as you said, it's dated the same day as the president's executive order.
Correct.
So how does this impact the ruling then from Boston Federal Court that we mentioned, the one that came through on Sunday morning that put a seven-day stay on the executive orders?
Well, it basically renders some of those actions ordered by the Boston Federal Court moot, really. I mean, because that order issued by judges happened early Sunday morning, and it specifically sought to protect all lawful immigrants, so all lawful visa holders. And so if the State Department issued this memo, as it's dated, on Friday, the 27th, effectively revoking visas for people traveling from those seven countries, then those folks would not have been valid visa holders by the time the order was issued here in Boston. I spoke with Carrie Doyle. She's one of the lawyers representing the plaintiffs in federal court. Here's how she explained it.
We had been under the impression it was more a problem with Customs and Border Protection and the admission process, and then the coordinating with the airlines, but we were unaware until that information became was released that there was an official memo from the State Department addressing the issue.
So this is why this is a major shift. It's taking the focus away from Customs and Border Protection, putting it back in Washington,
right,
and the State Department. But Shannon, when and where was this memo, or how was it first made public?
Right. So it is part of the court filings now in federal court here in Boston, but it wasn't filed until immediately before the lawyers working on this case issued their amended order. So basically, lawyers are telling me that they didn't know about this last weekend when they filed the original request. And like I said, they only learned about it immediately prior to filing this new petition. So they're sort of digesting the new information and coming up with a new strategy in terms of how to approach it in court. They were given the memo by the government. A State Department spokesperson says that at the request of the Department of Homeland Security and in compliance with the president's executive order, the Department of State has revoked visas for those seven countries. Those visas are not valid for travel to the U.S. while the executive order is in place. Now, the spokesperson did say that this has no impact on the legal status of visa holders who are already in the U.S., but presumably, those people should probably stay put, as they likely would not be allowed re-entry.
I see. So just to keep the sort of TikTok calendar straight here, this State Department memo, this new one that we're talking about, just to remind folks, it was issued, it was written up on January 27th,
same day
as the president's executive order.
Right.
It was filed in Boston federal court yesterday.
That's what the date at the top of the sheet that we've obtained says. It says filed January 31st, 2017.
Okay. And yesterday, of course, was also the day that the new case that Massachusetts is bringing against the president and his executive orders was announced.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. So so that was announced right after lawyers received a copy of this memo.
Right. So that brings us to this new case, which was, of course, supported by Attorney General Maura Healey. She talked about it at length yesterday, filed today by the ACLU of Massachusetts and others. This new case wants parts of that executive order to be declared permanently unconstitutional, to go beyond that 7-day stay. So how does this State Department memo then affect the case that's currently on its way to federal court?
Right. I think it's unclear right now how this information will affect things. What we do know is that lawyers are, like I said, trying to react and really come up with a strategy now that they have this new knowledge from the State Department memo. Carrie Doyle had this to say.
It's such new information, we need to digest it. And
okay.
I mean, as any litigation, you know, things come up, you have to make decisions on how to respond. So we're just digesting the information now, and then we'll make decisions going forward.
So a footnote in the new lawsuit actually states that lawyers for the plaintiffs didn't receive a copy of the memo until immediately, the State Department memo, until immediately prior to filing this latest amended order. So they are reserving the right to amend the amended petition.
Right. In fact, I'm looking at the footnote right here. It mm-hmm. says, this document, being the memo, was never before disclosed to the plaintiffs, nor was it disclosed to this court, meaning federal court, at the hearing on January 28th.
Right.
Plaintiffs reserved their right, as you said, to further amend this petition once the action, or purported action, in their words, by the assistant secretary is investigated. So lots going on here. Shannon, obviously you'll keep reporting on this, but what does it mean for the people who have bought tickets or are still hoping, planning to fly to the U.S. through Logan?
Well, so we had been seeing that lawyers and advocates were actually encouraging people to reroute through Boston's Logan after the court order was issued last weekend. And now that's not such good advice, it seems. If they are not lawful permanent residents, if people do not have a green card from those seven countries and they're instead traveling or trying to travel on a visa, the State Department has likely revoked it per that memo, and they will not be able to board the plane headed for the U.S. Now, Carrie Doyle, the lawyer, says she and her colleagues are trying to get this information out to immigration lawyers abroad to try to prevent people from, say, you know, buying a new ticket, trying to get into Logan and incurring all of that expense. But, you know, and thinking that they'll be able to land here because, in fact, chances are they won't be able to get on that plane.
Well, that's WBUR's Shannon Dooling bringing us up to speed on this major development in the federal case Massachusetts is bringing against President Trump's executive actions on immigration. This new State Department memo that has just recently revoking visas issued for visitors from seven different Muslim majority countries. Shannon, we've got links to the letter, memo, and the official complaint that's being filed in federal court at our website.
That's right. You can find it at WBUR.org.
Shannon, thank you as always.
Thank you.
All right. Well, let's turn now and get some reaction from a member of the Massachusetts congressional delegation. Bill Keating represents the 9th District. He also serves on the House Homeland Security Committee. He joins us from Washington. Congressman Keating, welcome back to the show.
Well, Meghna, it's great to be here. And if what I just heard, as your listeners heard, probably could be described in one word. It's not a legal word. Chaos. And that is what's happening and what's happened through this whole executive order. You know, it's on so many levels. It's created very serious problems. And one of them clearly is showing a lack of governing, because getting this information, not making it available to counsel that are bring suits forward. I was a DA before I did this job, and it's just not the way you handle legal issues, that so directly affect people's lives in particular. So the hardship continues, and the chaos just changes day to day on handling of this. But there are some things we do know about this, and I know also as the ranking member on terrorism and the Foreign Affairs Committee, that we are less safe with this executive order.
We are less safe, you say?
We are less safe. There's just no doubt in my mind, and I've been involved in this for several years now on the committees, both committees, Homeland Security and Foreign Affairs. And our greatest threat, just to put it in perspective, to our country and the citizens here, are homegrown extremists, people that are already here. Now, this executive order provides some of the strongest propaganda material that terrorist groups like Daesh or ISIS, that they have at their disposal, and they're already using it. They're saying, you know, see, we told you the U.S. hates Muslims,
mm-hmm.
and they're stirring people up. And the greatest danger is radicalizing someone that is already here with this kind of potent, it's not really propaganda, even though it's being used that. It's describing what the order is. And then even on the ground, this type of order hurts our military in the field. They rely on information, often from people that were in Iraq, you know, citizens, or people in Syria, people in Afghanistan. They risk their lives giving our military in the ground important information, you know, where there's an IED, the actions of the Taliban or extremist groups, the translators that are necessary to talk to local people.
Well, yeah, and in fact, in the initial days following the executive order, there was great confusion about whether those people, even after providing honorable assistance to the U.S. military, would be allowed to come to the United States. But Congressman, let me ask you, just this morning, President Trump tweeted, quote, "Everyone's arguing whether it is or isn't a ban. Call it what you want. It's about keeping bad people with bad intentions out of the country." And I would say, like, a lot of people agree with that. That's what they think this executive order has accomplished.
Well, yeah, he's describing something that's not real. There hasn't been a lethal terrorist attack back since, I think, 1975 or more, long before these other groups sprung up. From these seven, no one can really find one person that came from these seven countries. And he's describing it himself as a ban. I think he's trying to retreat because there's legal implications to that. But that's what it is. And it's also a ban of a religion. And no matter what he calls it, that's what it really is. So, you know, we're dealing in this new administration with alternate facts. Well, it continues. But importantly in this, you know, we're demonstrating as a country that we're also a rule of law country. And our courts have taken action. Now, it's complicated by this locally by this latest memo. But we're also demonstrating free speech and how people have come, to the streets, to the airports, to Congress, you know.
Yeah.
The other day, we had several thousand people in front of the Supreme Court on just very short notice as part of a demonstration. So we're demonstrating we have that. But this is a serious problem that will have long-term impact on the way we're viewed in the world as well.
Well, Congressman Keating, at the top of our conversation, I reminded folks that you sit on the House Homeland Security Committee. Are there discussions going on between your fellow committee members? Is there any action that that members of the House can take? I'm just wondering, as a lawmaker, as a representative for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, what do you think you can or should do?
Well, I'm an original co-sponsor of a bill that would repeal this if we could ever get it to the floor for a vote, which, given the Republican majority, is not likely with a Republican president. But if it were, I think we would have a good chance of repealing it and starting from scratch. if we had people voting on it, and certainly the public would like to see where their congressman stands to be accountable in this whole effort. Also, using my position on the Foreign Affairs Committee, I've contacted Secretary Kelly asking for further clarifications. He is late to the game. I don't think he was informed at an early time what the exact executive order was. He was left out of that.
Yeah, I mean, yesterday in a press conference, he said that his staff was, quote, generally informed. That's as specific as he got.
Yeah, well, I saw the same clip, and I think it's basically he said in the campaign he said he was going to do this. Well, you know, the way you govern on very important individual rights, basic human rights, and translate into an order legally, you should do that with some exactness. And we're just finding out again today with this memorandum that surfaced just how inept that effort was.
Mm. Well, Congressman Bill Keating represents Massachusetts' 9th District. He sits on the House Homeland Security and Foreign Affairs Committees as well. Congressman Keating, thanks so very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for keeping the public informed on what is a fundamental issue.
We'll be back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. So let's go back to the very beginning of President Donald Trump's campaign, June 16th, 2015, when he rode down that golden escalator at Trump Tower and said this.
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're not sending you. They're not sending you. They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with us. They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people.
And as we know, throughout his campaign, Trump promised to deport millions of people living in the United States illegally, to ban Muslims from the United States, from coming to the United States, to stop all refugees from entering the U.S. for 120 days, to secure the borders, essentially to, quote, put America first. Well, Boston has been one of the epicenters of the backlash against the president's rhetoric and actions. But guess what? The language, the nativist philosophy he espouses, was born here. Neil Swidey is a staff writer for the Boston Globe magazine, and his new piece about this is called Trump's Anti-Immigration Playbook was written 100 years ago in Boston. And Neil Swidey joins us in the studio. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Great to be back.
Okay, so Boston has the dubious honor of being the birthplace of some nativist rhetoric. Tell me about Prescott Farnsworth Hall, the man at the center of your story.
He's a fascinating guy. In many ways, he was part of the WASP declining class in the late 1800s when the Brahmins had kind of run the place for 100 years or 200 years. And their decline was beyond argument at that point. And I think what he saw as an intellectual, a Harvard-educated intellectual, grouping up with other Harvard graduates was a way to explain their decline and a way to warn the country about what's happening.
Okay. So he, as you said, teams up with a couple other Harvardians. And what, in the 1890s, they start the Immigration Restriction League?
Exactly. They start that in Boston. And the argument is that immigration is weakening us, that unchecked immigration is going to be our ruin. In some ways, the Brahmins had already missed the boat with the Irish in the mid-century, and the Irish were already well in control in terms of numbers and politics. And so they're warning the country that the immigration coming now, the new wave, which was a different complexion, it was Southern Italians and Eastern European Jews and Slavs and other people coming in, that this was going to be our ruin.
Interesting. Now, you write in your Globe magazine piece that even the similarities are so striking that some of the language that we heard in this past presidential election was almost identical to the language used in the 1890s by Hall and others.
It was eerie. And as I explained in the piece, I repeatedly would call over to my wife when I was reading that saying, you'll never believe what he said now. And that was happening all around the country with people talking about President Trump. And I was talking about this guy from the late 1800s.
I mean, drain that great swamp?
Drain that great swamp. Make the race that made America great, the criminal immigrants, the invading hostile army of immigrants that are going to make us weak. The rhetoric is the same. The rationale is the same, which from that clip from candidate Trump illustrates, which was, I'm okay with with immigrants in the past. It's the new immigrants. I'm not against immigration. I'm just against the immigrants now who are just lower quality than previous immigrants. Huh.
So Prescott Farnsworth Hall, I'm going to say his name over and over again because a Brahminical name I haven't heard more. But he and his fellow members of the Immigration Restriction League find a great advocate in the Senate in the form of Henry Cabot Lodge. I mean, a huge name in Massachusetts history.
The biggest, the owner of two of the biggest surnames in American politics, the Cabots and the Lodges. And people forget about this. Lodge was a complicated guy in many ways. He was somewhat progressive on race, but retrograde on immigration, and sort of believed in this point, not so much as much as Hall, but was united with him that this was a dangerous trend that had to be reversed.
Okay. Now, Hall and others wanted essentially to take their beliefs and encode it into U.S. law, right? You write interestingly about how they visited Ellis Island and observed how immigrants were being processed and welcomed as they came into the United States. And out of those observations, they came up with an idea for a literacy test?
Yes, this became their holy grail initially. I don't think initially that they could come out and say, we don't want this kind of immigrant from this kind of country. So the more palatable approach, the tactical approach, was to say, we don't want low-quality immigrants, and there's a direct connection, they would argue, between illiteracy in a native language and sort of low quality immigration stock. And so we'll push for this ban. And what was remarkable was they started out and they almost won very soon, 3 years after they founded this Immigration Restriction League. Both houses of Congress passed this literacy test. And it was only a presidential veto. President Cleveland, on the way out of the White House, vetoed this. And that became a pattern for years, and it took them 20 years, and we're coming up on the 100th anniversary this Sunday of their big win, which was the final passage in the overriding of a presidential veto making this literacy test law.
In 1917. Wow. Just before we move on to what happens next, I just want to reiterate something that you touched on earlier. The surge of immigration in the late 19th century was enormous. I mean, you have a fabulous fact there about how in places like Boston, there was this swing of who and how many people came to the point where, do I have this right? Like you said that 3/4 of people living in Boston were either immigrants or the children of immigrants?
Exactly. And not just Boston, pretty much every big city in the Northeast at that point. It was stunning how quickly that happened. And those population gains were enormous, and they were unsettling for a lot of people. And I try to make the point in the piece that people who are for immigration restriction are not necessarily racist or xenophobic or a nativist. There are some rationales that have basis to them that are supportable for some kind of restriction, some kind of sensible, coherent system.
Okay.
What these guys were talking about was something different, though.
Interesting. You also make the point, though, that this literacy test, which was made into law in 1917, didn't think about the southern border. It was thinking more about European immigration.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's amazing because Prescott Farnsworth Hall just didn't even think about Mexicans or Central Americans, and it was all about what's in front of you. And that's why I think when you look at the long arc of history in immigration, you find there are no new ideas in immigration. There are only new people espousing them, and that people are often fighting the last war. They miss what's coming by focusing on what was in the rearview mirror most recently.
Now, how long did the immigration test stay as part of U.S. law? I mean, the literacy test, I should say.
Well, the literacy test, I mean, what's stunning about this is, you know, as I started to look at the, you know, as I mentioned, 20 years before they really had a win, and they were yelling at the world until the last time the literacy test was vetoed, Prescott Hall famously said, to hell with Jews, Jesuits, and steamships, the steamships that were bringing all the immigrants in. So he looked defeated for a long time, and yet then 1917 was the sea change, because that was the big win there, and a far bigger one's happened in the 1920s that kind of codified and toughened these quotas and these restrictions. And what's remarkable is when you look at how immigration patterns changed for 40 years after that, It's stunning. They had their effect, and they really, in many ways, changed the complexion of this country. The percentage of foreign-born residents of this country went from 14% down to under 5%, and now we're back up around close to 14% again, which is interesting historically.
And, I mean, just to draw out sort of the Massachusetts connections here, correct me if I'm wrong, but decades later, it was Ted Kennedy's Immigration Act that got rid of the quotas.
Yes, 1965, Ted Kennedy, in the wake of John Kennedy's assassination, worked with people alongside others in Congress to push this through and say, this is kind of crazy, because what happened in the 1920s, based on the work of Prescott Hall and others, it got into the ether and into American politics that we were smart to really change our immigration patterns and really tip the scales in favor of Northern and Western Europeans, the so-called good Europeans, and against Eastern and Southern Europeans and Asians. Mm-hmm. And so that's what the complexion of immigration looked like for many years. Not only did the overall numbers go down, but the percentages went way up for Western and Northern Europeans.
Neil, I'm what I'm taken most by / alarmed is how you write in the story that it took decades for us to reach the next great milestone in immigration law and thinking about what immigration means. You write that the pendulum swings, but sometimes awfully slowly. I mean, is that what we're experiencing now, that we might be in a cycle that takes decades to play out?
It could well be. I mean, I think I look through history. When I feel unsettled, I kind of go back to history to find out where we are, because a lot of times we're looking just right in front of us. And I think you do take comfort in history that the arc comes back. You know, the pendulum will swing back, and maybe more sensible ideas about immigration, about this nation of immigrants that has been conflicted in many ways, that's always there. However, it will take a long time sometimes, and that can be unsettling in itself.
Well, Neil Swiede is a staff writer for the Boston Globe magazine. His new piece called Trump's Anti-Immigration Playbook was written 100 years ago in Boston is linked at our website, radioboston.org. Neil, thank you so much.
Thank you, Meghna. Great to be here.
Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It is Wednesday, which means it's time to talk with Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Hello there, Bill.
Hello, Meghna.
So it's great to have you in the studio, Bill. But haha, today we are also joined from Houston by WBUR's sports and society reporter Shira Springer, where she's on the ground covering the run-up to Super Bowl L.I. Shira, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. I'm here at Super Bowl L.I.
Every personal reference that I make to the Super Bowl is going to include L.I. But Shira, you left a press conference with Commissioner Roger Goodell. You know, what's your takeaway? What did he say?
Well, first of all, my big takeaway is just the NFL is masterful in managing its image. I think there were probably about 15 or so questions during this 40-minute press conference, maybe 15 or 20, and it seemed to me about half of them sounded like plants. And they were all geared toward, you know, how well the NFL is doing in NFL Europe. And then when the second question on the NFL's, how the NFL handles domestic violence violations by its players was asked, that was pretty much the end of the press conference.
Bill, we were just talking about this last week about how the NFL masterfully manages its image.
Yeah, they masterfully handle their image, but somehow we always end up talking about things like domestic violence, drug use, and concussions, no matter how well they handle their image. So maybe they don't handle it quite as well as they think they do.
Yeah, and Deflategate, by the way, because if I understand correctly, Commissioner Goodell specifically addressed in this press conference, Shira, criticism about his suspension of Tom Brady, but he said it was the appropriate reaction to the Deflategate violation.
We went through a process. We applied the discipline in accordance with our process. It was litigated, as you know, extensively and validated by the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. So we're moving on from that.
So Shira, Goodell's moved on, but Pats fans?
I don't think Pats fans or Boston media has moved on, because all of the tough questioning today came from members of the Boston media who wanted to ask Goodell, number one, about Deflategate and whether he was poorly advised on Deflategate and regrets the four-game suspension for Brady. They also asked him about his not coming to Gillette Stadium and whether or not he was avoiding Gillette Stadium. He hasn't been there since Deflategate broke. So, yes, Patriots fans haven't forgotten. Boston media hasn't forgotten. And I think whether the Patriots players say it aloud or not, this is very much a revenge story for them. They would like nothing better than to be there Sunday night, standing next to Roger Goodell and holding aloft the Lombardi Trophy as winners of Super Bowl LI.
Bill, are you trying to will yourself to forget?
No, I'm still trying to figure out whether when Deflategate broke, it made a bang or just a little hissing sound.
God.
This is one member of the Boston media who has moved on. I moved on, roughly 2 years ago. And ever since the day we went over and talked to the 11-year-old kid who'd proved that Deflategate was an utter hoax by putting a football out on his back porch and measuring how much air had leaked out of it. I've moved on. I'm out of here. I'm gone.
Well, let us collectively move on right now and talk about something else. But this is actually, I think really interesting because there have been some charges of transcript scrubbing on the NFL's official website. Bill, is this surprising to you? I think the Herald has reported that questions Tom Brady was asked about Donald Trump were scrubbed from the online write-up.
Yeah, the least of my worries regarding Donald Trump is what Tom Brady thinks about him. That's just not...
Although the president does go out of his way to talk about Brady's loyalty.
His friends Kraft and Belichick and Brady, they're all behind him, I know. I don't want to talk about it. I'm like Tom Brady.
Okay, well, we'll scrub
the only
that.
Way in which I'm like Tom Brady, but I don't want to talk about it.
I think different reasons you don't want to talk
maybe,
about it.
Maybe this is just another example of the way the NFL is handling its public relations, and that is by eliminating from the transcript those things that they don't wish us to recall.
Down the memory hole.
Sure.
I mean, Shira, what do you think about these scrubbing allegations?
Well, what I would say is, first of all, I was at almost the entire portion of Brady's media access on opening night, and then I have taken a look at the transcripts that the NFL provided. Yes, the Trump part is missing, but so is about two-thirds of what he said during that hour-long access. So we were also...
They took it out they wouldn't have to deal with it.
So we call that editing, right?
In this business.
Well, I would also say, you know, they took out some of the entertaining bits, too, because we were denied the transcript-wise, we were denied the privilege of knowing all about Brady's Australian surfing instructor, which he went into, talked about in some detail on opening night.
I'm boycotting the Super Bowl on that account. Because,
So Trump and Brady's surfing instructor were cut out of the transcripts. You know?
I suppose we probably should talk about the actual game coming up, because I see that public policy polling, polling, we're going to talk about polling, but I'm going to do this anyway, finds that 53% of Americans want Atlanta to win and only 27% want the Patriots to win. I think maybe all 27% were polled but were Boston residents. Who knows? Is this sort of a evil empire kind of matchup that people want an underdog to win here, Bill?
If it is, it's more another example of the NFL's brilliant public relations. Because if they can convince people that this is, in fact, Han Solo against the evil empire or something to that effect, even more people will watch and pay attention and watch the advertising, and they'll have a bigger audience than ever. I think these things are true because people think they are true. So if somebody in Wisconsin or somebody in California or Denver thinks the Patriots are the bad guys and is happier chewing on the fact that there's a villain in the Super Bowl that they can root against, more power to them. It makes it more fun for them, I'm sure.
Sure, we got a couple seconds.
I was going to say, I agree with Bill. It's always good to have a good narrative to compel people to watch the Super Bowl. But I do think, you know, the Patriots also have an embarrassment of riches when it comes to Super Bowls and playoff wins and Super Bowl trophies. I mean, let's not forget Brady's been a starter for 16 years. And I think almost 7 of those years he's made it to the Super Bowl. So almost half of his career he's ended the season in the Super Bowl. So it's easy to be jealous of that, and I think jealousy breeds a certain amount of contempt among NFL fans. So I think that's something of what we're witnessing, too, with those poll numbers.
Well, Shira Springer is WBUR Sports and Society reporter joining us from Houston today. Shira, thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me.
And Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. You can hear it on Saturdays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. Bill, thanks as always.
My pleasure, Magna. Thank you.
This week, WBUR has been bringing you a special series called This Moment in Cancer. It's about the new excitement Boston cancer researchers are feeling that cutting-edge therapies and technologies could transform the way we treat the disease. Today, we're going to hear what this moment means to a patient.
My name is David Kimball. I'm 64 years old. I was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer in 2012, and for the last years, I've been the beneficiary of treatment at first Yale Cancer Center in New Haven, and then when the drugs that they had there weren't appropriate for my genetic makeup, I transferred in 2013 to Massachusetts General Hospital, their cancer center.
2012 was when you were diagnosed.
Yes, and if you just look at the raw statistics, stage 4 lung cancer survival rate is not really expected to be much more than a year, year and a half.
And here we are in 2017.
It's not in a place I ever expected to be.
Stage four.
Yeah. That means it was in my spine, it was in my lymph nodes, my chest, and somewhere else.
So, Dave, let me ask you. First of all, lung cancer, the first thing people think of is smoking?
Not once in my life ever. I mean, the statistics for lung cancer are interesting. It's sort of a disease that we look at and frown, saying you caused it yourself, you've taken to smoking, and smoking is going to kill you. But it isn't always that case.
When you first got that diagnosis, I mean, was there a moment where you looked at your wife, at your family, and you thought, well, I'm going to die?
Well, I knew this is going to kill me. It wasn't a question of maybe. So I just accepted.
How did you choose what kind of therapies you were going to go after or what kind of patient you were going to be? Because, you know, there's a fork in the road, a multiplicity of choices that people can make.
Yeah, but we, again, do not really fall into the middle of any group. We happen to live in maybe one of the best places on the planet if you have a disease like this. We never, and I don't think people should, consider a drug trial as a last resort. It's as good, and maybe, for me, it was much better to do that early rather than later. Jumping in is why I'm here 4 years later or 5 years later. It's not because they took the off-the-shelf stuff.
How did you become part of the drug trials? Was that hard?
For us, knowing that drug trials are really the forefront of patient care, we looked for them. And going to the cancer centers, we did Yale and Boston. That's where all the action is. It was
so,
a match.
Yeah. You make a really good point there because I'm thinking, you know, in other parts of the country, people might have to work really hard to find the trials, locate where they are, and contact the researchers doing it and see if they can get in.
People come from hundreds, if not thousands of miles in the waiting room in Boston. There's so many seats. When the seats fill up, you're not in. And you know, this is life or death to some degree. Mm-hmm.
What were the first treatments that you received?
I am a person with non-small cell adenocarcinoma with a mutation called EGFR. And the EGFR mutation has a drug that's been on the market for about 10 years, maybe a little longer, called Tarceva. I took that initially, and the response was very positive, very quick.
Did it stop the growth of the tumor?
It reversed it to some degree. I've had a whole series of metastases in my brain, and the treatment for that is wild.
What is it?
Stereoscopic radiosurgery. They can pinpoint the target of the X-ray precisely at the small tumors in your brain and move you around, and they shoot them one at a time. And
what was it like being in the machine?
Oh. They screw this halo onto your head, and when you lie down in the X-ray machine, you're bolted. Your head is sort of clamped into it. and you slide in. It's much bigger than an MRI, but you get moved around and zip, 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 zip. They shoot one at a time. The biggest of the brain tumors that they think are worth getting. And getting to that point involved a whole series of dialogues. Is it worthwhile doing this? What are the consequences? What are the alternatives? And we spent days thinking about that, because the alternative to a radio-targeted surgery is what they call whole brain radiation. You only do whole brain radiation when things are really bad, because you don't come out usually the same.
But you didn't have to do that.
We were very, very lucky.
So do you still have tumors in your brain?
Yes.
Okay.
The current drug I'm on, my third really, seems like it continues to hold the brain tumors in check.
What was different or special about that drug?
Well, that was Tagrisso.
Yeah.
As I said, my first genetic target was EGFR. Uh-huh. And when the EGFR drugs stop working, there's another sign or that they go after, which is called the T790 mutation. And I have that. For T790, Clovis started to go after that. That drug failed. I was the first person to be switched from Clovis to AstraZeneca's drug, and they didn't know if it would work, and it did. And now a whole bunch of folks have been switched over.
Okay. So these are drugs that, that target specific genetic factors
very,
in,
very
your tumor,
specific.
In your tumors?
Yes.
Okay.
My particular mutations really fall into like the small percentage of people with lung cancer.
Yeah.
So it's like this tree that keeps branching, and I've been lucky to have my branches walk down the path that the drugs happen to be, you know, coming out of the gate.
For the other treatments that you received before the current treatment that you're undergoing, did you have side effects?
Yes. The Tarceva was just normal side effects, nausea, some skin things, very understandable, manageable, and I didn't react far out in the extremes. I was pretty normal. The second drug, a Clovis drug trial, which because of its side effects was pulled from the market, and the consequences I got was very, very high blood sugar, higher than a diabetic would get. It really just shot way up. They had to keep reducing the dose. It stopped working. I switched to a different drug. And then a few months later, I'm talking to my docs, and she said, you know something? We're asking everybody about their vision. How's your vision? I said, you're coming in lately. It's been really, through the tunnels, really kind of blurry. She said, well, you know what? We've scheduled 3 or 4 Clovis patients for cataract surgery. Let's check your eyes. And it turns out I had, because of the drug, ended up with cataracts in both eyes and ended up getting cataract surgery.
But you're not on that drug.
That drug is off the market. I'm on the next one, which was AstraZeneca's Tagrisso. I was on it as a trial. It's now been released for general use.
I see. Okay. So that's what you're being treated with right now?
Well, that has stopped working except for the brain. The lungs, it wasn't doing very good. So I'm now on chemotherapy. So at 1 o'clock today or 2 o'clock today, I'll get chemotherapy.
As in, like, kind of more traditional chemotherapy?
Very traditional. So I've run out of magic pills. So?
Running out of magic pills, how do you feel about that?
I wish science was a little bit more advanced. I mean, I know it's going to happen. It's just the clock is not perfect for me. But I just got 5 years out of them, so most people don't get that.
Has insurance covered everything for you so far? You're smiling, sighing.
You know, I have been the beneficiary of probably the best insurance policy in the country because my wife works for a state government. So I'm very happy with my life and my situation. I don't think as many people would be as lucky.
Because I imagine that these haven't been cheap therapies.
The pills on the street market are, I don't know, 50, 70,000 a year, maybe more. I've taken a lot of drugs. I think I took 8 or 9 this morning. I've never once seen what any one drug costs. All I know is my copay, $5.
You said you've run out of magic pills. That's how you phrased it when it comes to the drug trials that you were on. You don't regret having done any of the trials?
Not for a minute. I mean, I'm here.
Yeah. Do you think that...
I rode a year and a half ago in the men's nationals. only because of the drugs. I mean, my quality of life has not been what a lung cancer patient stage four should have been.
So do you feel like that there's more hope because of the trials and treatments and research that's going on now than if you had been diagnosed, say, 10 years ago?
The way my doc describes progress in lung cancer specifically, she says in the last 10 years, there's been 12 drugs approved for lung cancer, and 8 of those were last year. And so everybody knows there's going to be some real tremendous valuable progress, hopefully soon.
Hopefully soon for you.
Soon for everybody. You know, there's a long queue here. People are joining this bus all the time.
Do you feel like there's a possibility that because there seems to be so much excitement and sense of progress that some patients may experience a false hope?
Well, I think we all listen to the words that describe the upsides of our futures rather than listen to the words that talk about the pitfalls, because it's so much more what we want to hear. I could tell you have 20% chance of this working out well and you're pretty happy. I would be. I mean, it doesn't really pay to focus on the other side.
No, it doesn't. Do you and your doctors, your family, talk about what your prognosis is now?
My wife understands that, but just doesn't want to go there and talk about it. My doc, when I talk to her, I think we're pretty honest. And it doesn't take a lot of words for me to understand. I mean, I look at numbers, and I can see.
What are the numbers saying?
Yeah. Let's assume that the targeted therapy keeps the metastases in the brains in check. The lungs are going to probably spike out when this treatment benefit goes away. And what I'm taking now, the carboplatin, is not given regularly, because if you take too much of it, it'll kill you.
This is the chemo?
Yeah, the chemo. Chemo, you take it until you get the benefit and you stop. I'm thinking that I may not be as happy in a year. Just before I started chemo, where the other drugs wore off, my chest disease progressed, and I was on a fair amount of oxycodone. There was a lot of pain, and it came on really sudden, and it just wasn't fun. So I know this thing kicks in really fast when it gets going.
You're writing about your experiences with cancer and cancer treatment. Why?
That's a hard question. The idea that the more people feel they're in this together and want to help each other, I think the better we'll be in everything. And this, and cancer is just one of the things in life. It creates an awareness of the value of life. I now have a date. I know things are really quite finite. So I've done some things. I'm surprised at how many things that we did in this short while. I appreciate the days that I have alive.
I imagine that there are a lot of people hearing this who either possibly going through this themselves or know someone, because as you said so eloquently, there's a lot of people getting on that bus. What do you want them to know? What's your message to them, especially given that, you know, we're having this conversation in the context of there does seem to be so much more excitement around treatment? What do you want your fellow cancer patients to know?
Well, for those that are not aware of the value of targeted therapies and drug trials, that's an option they should consider earlier rather than later. There's not a good reason to wait. That's just the treatment side. The other part of this equation is living with cancer. And what I've tried to do is to use that experience as a way to make me appreciate more what I do have and try to focus less on what I'm going to lose. And I've been very fortunate that the pain and the disabilities have been minimal for my situation, and that's not the case for many people. They have a lot of things that distract them. But until you get to that point, let's celebrate life and let's reach out to the people that we care and love so much and tell them.
Yeah. Well, Dave Kimball, thank you so much. Thanks for coming in.
It was an honor. It's a privilege to have this chance. Thank you.
Well, as you heard Dave say, he feels tremendously lucky that he's had the doctors, drug trials, and insurance he's had to get this far in his treatment. Tomorrow in WBUR's special series, This Moment in Cancer, we'll look at what happens for patients who aren't so lucky, the poor and people of color. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.